It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 88.
Speculating on how quickly Greenland will become a tropic destination.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have a very special guest today, Tobias Bickel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we will skip all of the sort of, you know, what got you started with writing, because we already asked those questions the last time you were on the show. So we're actually going to just sort of dig right into the book, your book that is coming out on the 28th, if Amazon is correct. Arctic Rising. So where did the idea for this particular book come from? Because I'm interested in that, because I remember when you talk about Sly Mongoose, one of the ideas came from a talk that you saw on Venus, and about like how you would have airships. And in this case, we're talking about a very different kind of future and where, you know, global warming has destroyed everything. So what kind of compelled you to write about this?
Well, what started the general idea was a short story that Carl Schrader and I wrote together. And when we were coming up with ideas, he suggested, you know, taking a look at the North, where, you know, the polar ice, the Arctic would have completed melting and that would have opened up. And that kind of got me reading a lot of documents about that and looking at some memos that had been prepared by the various navies. And after that, every time I started reading about just near future stuff, I just kept stumbling across stuff that seemed relevant, and I just kept archiving it after we'd finished writing our story. And eventually I got the idea that I really wanted to write a book set in the polar Arctic North when it had finished, just even completed melting, not just the sort of semi-melted state that we had talked about in our own short story. And there's just so much conflict that comes out of that, because, you know, resources would have, you know, be opened up, the entire balance of power will have changed, and all the different nations will be trying to figure out how to police and, you know, have navies up there. So it just kind of jumped out and caught my attention.
So this book, what I found really interesting, because, and I will be completely honest, I haven't read most of your books, but my familiarity with them is that most of them are space adventures.
Right.
And this one is essentially a thriller. I mean, it actually reminded me of, you know, Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon or Reamed or Paolo Bacigalupi's Wind Up Girl. What made you decide on a thriller instead of a more typical science fiction?
Well, you know, I was definitely a child of the cyberpunk days, where we were, you know, reading a lot of books that dealt with the near future, what was just around the corner. And that slipped out of fashion for a while, but it definitely had a huge impact on me. And to be honest, it is still one of my favorite kind of areas to look at, that just sort of 40 years out, 50 years out type of stuff. I think a lot of people avoid it because of the fear of prediction, but I was just talking to Carl about that this evening earlier, that I'm really fascinated by thinking of it more as extrapolation. There's this sort of wavefront of speculation that's pushed out just in front of where we can see things, and it's sort of like a frothy mix of potential and questions that need asked and scenarios that need put out there to be evaluated, that I think are very useful in sort of helping take a look at the future. And I really wanted to experiment with more of it myself. I've been doing it in short fiction. I've done a few novellas, particularly for Metatropolis, that John Scalzi and Jay Lake put together, where I had stories that kind of tried to deal with some stuff that was just around the corner. And in my space adventures, I do deal with technology a fair amount. I'm really interested in participatory democracy after reading about a lot of stuff that's happening in Brazil, which really undergirds a lot of the thought that was going into Sly Mongoose, as well as the background of the setting that I got from a NASA scientist who was giving a lecture, Jeff Landis. And in Ragamuffin, the science that I was fascinated in was reality markup. Instead of cyberspace, you have augmented reality, where, you know, digital maps are laid down on top of what's real. So you have glasses that give tags and, you know, add Google Maps to your environment and show you where the nearest subway is and stuff like that. And so in Ragamuffin, it's a space opera, but it's very much, you know, undergirded by my own trying to figure out augmented reality a little bit more. So for me to kind of jump into this is, it wasn't that huge of a jump for me, but because it's not space adventure, I think I'm getting a lot more attention paid to the sort of thought experiments I'm throwing out there.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things is that it's been a while since I've touched on Ragamuffin, as in last year I think I have 10,000 of those little paper markers in my copy of Ragamuffin. But I did think that one of the interesting things about your technology is the way that people can communicate and the way they, you know, drive their ships. And of course, you do a lot of very interesting – and you, like you said, you do a lot of very interesting technological things here. In terms of like crowd searching, or I don't know what exactly you call
crowd sourcing. That's actually one of our future next questions.
Oh, is it?
Sure.
Okay. Go, Jen.
Crowd sourcing. Well, okay. So, I mean, Rue, I love Rue.
Thank
he's
you.
Awesome. I figured he's got the coolest job and the coolest house. So I'm totally my hero, but his spy techniques really relied, I don't know if heavily is the right word, but a lot on crowdsourcing, which is a concept I haven't really seen explored in science fiction yet. But it seems to work really well for him, at least in your novel. Do you think this is a pretty likely future intelligence strategy?
Well, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that someone coming, you know, the what crowdsourcing does is it allows you to leverage an existing platform and use a sort of existing user base to create, to go through monotonous tasks for you if you're willing to pay a chunk of money to them. And I think that is useful because it would allow like a Caribbean nation that doesn't have an existing sort of massive spy network to go ahead and use, you know, some upfront cash to quickly and on the fly sort of create instant spy networks for itself, particularly if you obscure it. What people are doing. So you create, in Rue's case, he spies on the U.S. and U.N. Coast Guard by creating a U.S. Coast Guard Boat Appreciation Society.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. So what they do is, you know, these people log and take pictures of awesome boats that they see around and kind of pin them. And then that gives him a live and updated map of where they all are so that he can do what he needs to do. And I mean, on the one hand, it's humorous, but on the other hand, that idea comes from, I remember I'd just written a short story exploring this recently, and, you know, like the criminal uses you could put crowdsourcing towards. And then not long after that, I saw this article where someone had hired some 50 people to all show up near a bank wearing the same uniform, and he robbed the bank and dressed up in that uniform and walked out into the crowd that showed up that all looked identical so that when the police showed up, they just didn't have the manpower to arrest all those people who were very confused and not sure what was going on. And there was no way the bank that had just been robbed could identify him because here were all these people that were dressed the same and everyone began to doubt their eyewitness testimony and whatnot. So this guy was able to just kind of scoot and get out of there. And I thought, wow, that's insanely clever. And what other, you know, what other weird... That's the funny thing about technology is that, you know, there's what it's supposed to be used for. And right now we're using crowdsourcing to do, you know, like solving interesting things and helping science and doing all these responsible things. But I'm like, it's the, you know, gray areas and weird areas that I think it'll be interesting where it shows up and does weird things. And that's one of them.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned what Gaia does with a similar sort of tactic. Did they create a game or something? Stevenson had the same sort of concept in Reamed, where in a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, and they're actually doing jobs for companies.
Right.
And you had the same sort of concept with Gaia, that somehow they had extrapolated things or worked on things by using people who are doing normal everyday computer, you know, games or whatever, and did their work for them, essentially.
Yeah, Gaia uses it for beta testing and for marketing. So they get people to be involved in what they think is a game, but it's actually just market research for them. And this is some of the stuff that's kind of wild. It's around the corner, because there are conferences now where people are being, you know, people who make games are being brought in to try and explain to companies how to make work more fun, the gamification of work, which is a little scary. But on the other hand, if you think about it, a lot of games are involved in very dull, repetitious work. You know,
right.
It's like, click this, you know, grab 100 coins until you can level up, you know, things like that.
EverQuest, anyone.
Exactly. And so when you design a game, a lot of times people are finding ways to reward you for doing repetitive work and for getting sucked into that gaming world. And so what people are trying to do is find ways to also replicate that for other areas. And so, yeah, it's just something that's been on my mind is since I read I just read a book about, like, you know, how to gamify your work environment. And so when I was writing the book, I was definitely thinking of where can I plug in crowdsourcing and gamification, you know, here and there, just to demonstrate what is casually used, you know, 40 years down the road and not a big deal to these people.
I'm just imagining that all of the jobs that nobody wants to do getting turned into, you know, you can go online and you can play a game and you can win coins to play another game.
Sure.
And you're doing all these what appear to be boring tasks like moving barrels.
There was a great, what's the science and media videos that people post all the time?
Ted.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. There was a TED conference video of a guy who was talking about rewarding people for doing literally everything, like,
yes,
brushing your teeth and, I don't know, tying your shoes, exercising, you know, making everything a game in order to get people to do the things that you want them to do. And, you know, mm-hmm. Greatest concept ever, and it made me start thinking about parenting, to be honest. I mean, because we do it in parenting anyway. It's
sure.
Already kind of an inborn concept to being a parent. You reward your children for doing the things that you want them to do. It made complete sense to put it out on a grander scale.
It's exciting, it's interesting, it's also a little scary, you know, when
yes.
Target starts gamifying your shopping, and
right.
when they, you know, it's going to be human and messy. And so it's just, you know, nowadays when I'm trying to write, I'm trying to keep aware of more of that stuff and trying to figure out, like, how do I just slip this in here and there and really, really add it.
Well, and I know that we talked somewhat about, and this is related to all of these issues of technology, and you talked about, you know, your own interest in crowdsourcing. And I'm very curious, since this is obviously a novel about climate and environmental concerns and these issues of new uses for technology. I mean, what is it for you that sort of draws you to green technology, broadly speaking, and the issues surrounding it?
What draws me to it is an attempt to bring a little bit more nuance to it. I'm sure there's some people out there who are not going to feel that the novel is nuanced at all, just because I dared sort of work from a suggestion that global warming is real, and so that puts me on a certain side of a fence for some people. But most people understand where I'm coming from, which is that, you know, this is happening. I mean, you know, 90 to 95% of all scientists are pretty much, you know, screaming at us like, you know, holy crap, pay attention. You know, and it's becoming, you know, one of those things where we have this severe disconnect between, you know, the people who are ruling our country and the business leaders of the country and, you know, the thought leader, the scientists and people who are, you know, doing all this research. So there's this tremendous disconnect, and that's kind of a bit frightening when you have that. And so, you know, one, there's that tension, and two, there's the tension that what happens is when people are trying to have this sort of debate is that you have even the people who are basically saying that we need to worry about global climate change sometimes they're the way in which they come across is really frustrating. This sort of what I call hair shirt environmentalism, at least I don't call that, I just picked up that phrase, drives me nuts, right? This sort of like, oh my gosh, we all need to, you know, go back to eating nothing but, you know, fruit and grass and, you know, living in a, you know, living in an area where, you know, we all are one with nature and so forth and so on. And, you know, it's one of those things where I wanted to sort of just dive in there and assume that, like, you know, it is completely feasible that humanity will survive global climate change. You know, if this goes on, life will go on. It's just that it'll be harder and it'll be more complicated. And so, you know, the Arctic North completely goes away and the only place we have polar bears is in a little, you know, collection of ice where we make a national park in the North Pole just for the hell of it. And, you know, oil and gas companies have found cheap oil in the North, so they're pumping that out because we'll always need plastic. Even if we go completely oil free in terms of transportation, we use plastics like crazy in our modern world. And it's one reason why I freak out about oil, is because I would rather see it used for plastic than for transportation, because once you burn it, it's gone forever. But if you make plastic, plastic can be recycled. So, you know, I'm not even like against drilling for oil in any fundamental way. It's just that I think we're using it for the wrong thing. And, you know, just these sort of like complex looks, which is that it would be nice if we could turn this back, but let's assume that we haven't and that it's getting messier. Well, let's just play with the, you know, play with the outcomes of that. And I don't know if it's a dystopia as such. Some people think it's really messy. Much like cyberpunk, a lot of people thought cyberpunk was dystopic. And I thought, no, it's just a very realistic look at a complex world. I mean, growing up in the third world, the developing world, I, you know, saw a lot more, you know, it's unevenly distributed futures is what William Gibson calls it. And I grew up in the unevenly distributed, you know, world, which wasn't the developed world. And so I just wanted to sort of bring that look I have to the rest of the world and explore what the future kind of might look like if we don't stop this.
Because you brought up the idea that you know, some have considered this a dystopia, and it seems kind of strange to me to call this book dystopia or call a good deal of cyberpunk. I mean, some of it probably is, you know, cyberpunk is dystopian, but because this is, if they're to think that, then they have to look at the world around them and think, like, we live in hell, you know, because if you just look at the world as it is this exact moment, I mean, there's revolutions going on, there's mounting pressures between the U.S. and Iran and China and Russia and all this crazy, like, we would this is just sort of a realistic look at, you know, if global warming turns out to be 100% correct and things change, well, it's going to be messy because that's sort of how the wheel turns in human culture. It's not going to be like, we found the cure and here's utopia and everything's pretty and we have, like, we fly in hover cars and, like, the Jetsons and everything's happy. Like, I just don't buy that, you know, this is dystopian. I mean, it would be dystopian if, like, everybody was being sent to, like, a meat grinder, you know?
Sure. And one of the other things I did want to engage in is the idea that the simplistic idea that is I find very commonly in science fiction fandom, which is that, you know, oh, if we can just build an X, some kind of technology, a machine, if we just use this solution, we can just geoengineer our way out of global warming, so we don't need to worry about it. And that is a real big problem. The least of which is because anytime you build something that could solve the problem of global warming with one hack, you're basically building a super weapon, the likes of which Dr. No would have given his left nut to be able to own. And who controls that is the question. And that is actually the heart of basically, if you read the book, that's the heart of my kind of critique of, you know, the sort of, we don't need to worry about it. Geoengineering solution, which is that, you know, in this book, someone has built a device that is a hack that they think will solve global warming, and they promptly lose control of it. And that is even messier than what global warming would bring to the table in some ways.
Power to the people. So, I mean, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but one of the big points is that you're showing how the political landscape on Earth has changed because of the fact that the North has opened up. Arable land in the North has increased, but presumably that means that there's more droughts in the South. Mm-hmm. But likewise, there's a clear sense that many of the nations of the world are really just not going to take it anymore, as demonstrated by Anika's attachment to the United Nations Polar Guard and how much attention your first few chapters pay to nuclear waste dumping in the ocean and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about this future landscape, both in terms of the environmental politics and the new sort of geopolitical landscape?
Sure. Well, right now they're already using the term potential Arctic tigers, which is the fact that as the ice continues to melt up there, you get the ability for places like Canada and Russia and Norway and the Nordic countries to all ship over the Northwest Passage to each other without having to go all the way down through the U.S. or through the Panama Canal or through all the traditional routes of shipping. So that creates a economic change in and of itself immediately. Secondly, all of the oil and gas that's up there immediately is available to places like Russia, again, Norway, the Nordic nations, and Canada. So it changes a lot of the equation, yes, definitely. And so above and beyond the idea of Arctic tigers is also the fact that you then have to worry about just who is planting. I mean, one of the reasons America has a very great presence, economic presence, is we have this fantastic agricultural system and fantastic amounts of arable land. And what happens when your breadbasket begins to migrate north? Well, it heads off into Canada, and Canada becomes the bigger breadbasket, and all of the arable land that has previously been under ice in places like the Ukraine, northern Russia, northern Canada, open up. That changes a lot of things. And when most of your southern areas of the U.S. just fall into drought, it just creates this very interesting shift. And, you have to kind of just play with that. Unfortunately, what's going to happen is that all of your coastal areas and all of your currently equatorial areas end up being battered way more by global warming than your areas that are sort of more northerly. And that, will create even more tensions between, I think, the developing world and not. But, then I also posit that Nigeria and major parts of Africa are extremely developed and suburban. I talk about Anika's background being the fact that she grew up in a city. She grew up in Lagos. Lagos is extremely developed in 50 years, because I was talking, one of the things I was trying to do was show her life as being a little bit more from what feels like a developed world nation, even though Nigeria is going through a tremendous amount of trouble right now. Because I remember, it was one of my grandparents was really shocked when all of that outsourcing started going to India, and she started to see pictures of skyscrapers and suburban areas in India. And because in her experience, India was a place where in the 70s, they had pictures of starving children and rice crop failures and drought, and everyone was being exhorted to send money to help the poor starving Indians. And they looked at India much in the way we look at parts of Africa today. So to me, the thought was that it's pretty amazing once a country reaches a tipping point in Southeast Asia and places like that, they can tip over into what we would call developed world fairly quickly, or at least in urban areas, they can tip over fairly quickly. And so I really wanted to show that, in the future, right now Africa is going through an incredible growth period. And I'll often do this trick where I show people a picture of an African skyscraper city line and ask them, where is this? Where do you think this is? And they'll have no idea. They'll, toss out a few examples and they'll say, this is a place in Africa. This is the skyline of Lagos. This is the skyline of, somewhere other than South Africa. People know South Africa has skyscrapers, but most people don't know that outside of, you know, South America, you have actual skyscrapers and roads and things like that. I mean, people's ideas of what it is are very, you know, simplistic. Yeah. So, you know, I'm trying to demonstrate that it's a grimy future, but it's still a future in which, you know, there's been development and change. And, you know, one of our characters comes from the Midwest of the U.S. where there are still suburbs, and, you know, that stuff is all still there, but it's just heavily impacted by these changes.
Can I just say that when I found out that Anika was Nigerian, I actually, like, did a little cheer. I was really happy.
Oh.
It was just really nice to see a protagonist who was not, you know, just an American or, you know, some stand-in for a version of American, but B was, you know, from some other place, but it also wasn't white, which, you know, is obviously a fairly normal thing in your books. I mean, your characters come from various places. But I just was happy. I don't know why, I just really liked it. I was happy.
well, thank you.
And also Rue is Jamaican, which was cool. It's also cool. So, okay, that's my little geeky moment, and I should probably stop doing that too much.
Such a dork.
I am such a dork. Well, I actually have a question, because you've talked a little bit about, you know, you're positioning this novel that comes at taking an automatic assumption that global warming will be true, and this is a possible future for what the new world might look like. And I'm curious, since you are so interested in sort of the green movement and issues about, you know, transportation, I mean, if anyone reads your blog, I mean, I swear, 3 or 4 times a month you talk about China building a new rail system.
Yes.
They have a lot of rail, I guess, over there, just lying around.
Yes. Yeah. Well, but 1 billion Chinese are all now within 1 hour's transportation of each other.
And yet we can't even do that. What the hell, guys? Jeez. What I'm curious is, do you think that the U.S. will somehow find its way out of the hellhole that is the sort of environmental politics to a much more reasoned approach to the issue of energy, whether that's to accept that global warming is true and to try to stop it, or at least, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be that. But, you know, this idea that like, it's almost hostile sometimes in the U.S. to just the idea of building a railway system. Do you think that we'll find our way out of it, or no?
Well, you know, that's prediction, not extrapolation. that's a tough call. Ultimately, I have a tremendous amount of faith in market economies, and the U.S. is more or less fundamentally a market economy. There are some problems in it in that we heavily socialize very large corporations. We socialize their losses and allow them to privatize their profits, particularly with banking. And I think that is a troubling sign. That's sort of an old empire sign. You know, when the British Empire is getting old and ossifying for a while, there, the only thing it does well, really, really well for a while, is it's the economic nerve center of the post-Commonwealth area, until it started to get really back on its feet and turn outward again. And I'm sure lots of people are going to write me and hate me for saying that. And hey, I'm a card-carrying Brit. I actually have the passport, so it's not I'm not bagging on it. Obviously, Britain has turned around to do other things, and I think the U.S. can too. Sometimes civilizations go through, you know, some periods where they're not really sure what direction they're taking. But I think fundamentally, a market economy will figure out the right direction, because it has to. As much as we have, you know, the forces of big oil and whatnot that are funding right now a tremendous amount of advertising and directly paying climate change deniers, I think the Heartland Institute report just revealed that climate change deniers are being paid on the order of $300,000 a year to spread what they're spreading, which is good money if you can get it. So what we have are these market inequalities where these things are happening. But, you know, on the other side, I think any insurance company that is rational and intelligent is going to begin to pour huge money into fighting that, because they have actuarial tables that demonstrate that global warming is going to really kind of force them to bend over and take it. And I think they're going to begin to sort of fight to sort of demonstrate that, you know, pollution needs to have a cost. See, if you in a market economy, if you do not put a price tag on something that eventually costs the society as a whole, that creates problems. And I think right now we do not price any of our market economies in the world don't, you know, but particularly in the U.S., we do not price pollution and carbon and heat. And I think once we get to a point where we can price those in right now, we can truly begin to sort of adapt our behavior. Because the thing is, every time you dump carbon into the atmosphere, whether it is a power plant station, it's your car, it's your production process that brings your flat screen to your home, that all puts, you know, more waste heat into the atmosphere, and that creates climate change. And so I think when we get to the point where that's priced into your objects, then you will naturally, without needing tremendous amounts of regulation, be able to adapt your behavior accordingly. So when gas goes up, there's a point at which you start saying, well, do I really want a car just for myself, or do I want to relocate to a denser area where I can participate in public transportation? You know, right now in the U.S., most of us live in a fairly urban area that's more dense than not. So obviously, even without actual pricing of carbon, as a society, we're beginning to demonstrate a preference for being in denser areas. And right now, even though people are fighting that, and even though some people are, you know, allied against that and think that, you know, density is some sort of liberal plot, the fact of the matter is people are voting with their feet. And so I think in 20 or 30 years, you know, the nature of what, you know, our society looks like, it's denser, it's more oriented around urban areas. The trend for the past 100 or so years has been for areas like where I live, which is a rural area, to become less and less dense. People are leaving. And so as that happens, you know, for example, in my area, you know, roads are kind of like the ultimate form of welfare. And the reason I'm obsessed with transportation is because it's not a sustainable form of welfare, because it provides a huge drag on the rest of the more efficient parts of society that are organized around more urban areas. So, for example, like a city like Columbus, Ohio, is a denser, more efficient form of movement, transportation, and organization. And the reason why rail makes an incredible amount of sense is because as you have more and more denser areas like cities, you know, connecting them with a rail is more efficient than laying out grids and grids of roads that connect every theoretical rural area, just because, you know, somebody wants to drive their Ford F-150 around the rest of the state. You know, that worked when we were laid out more evenly back at the turn of the century, but I don't think it's really a rational way of approaching it now. So I think as we begin to price like gasoline more effectively, and because right now if you pollute, if a large company pollutes, then in comes the federal government and the EPA, and they assign a very small fine, and they spend like just hundreds of millions of dollars cleaning up that pollution, right? It all comes on them. And if someone pollutes just enough that it's not being tracked very much and it just spreads evenly throughout the world, then that comes up in terms of that hits you in terms of just quite simply healthcare costs. And I think Next Big Future estimated that you know, billions and billions of dollars are being spent unnecessarily on healthcare costs due to pollution in our country. And the cost of regulating that pollution would be less than the actual healthcare costs. So I think at some point, you know, some very, very clever lawyer or some very, very clever person working for the, you know, health insurance companies are just going to basically hit one of these, you know, companies that's dumping, say, for example, mercury into the atmosphere with a massive lawsuit that says, hey, just the sheer, you know, backlog of our cases of asthma that can be somewhat indirectly associated with this higher level of pollution is costing our company this much money. So we're now going to bill you for that, okay, because you're the one directly causing it. And once you get to this system of accountability, I think a market economy will begin to self-correct. But whether we can do that in time or not, I don't know. It's somewhat, you know, some nights I stay up worrying that we won't we won't be able to correct it if certain people say, oh, you can't sue them for polluting because we have to have that energy. So that's off the table. And there's some ways in which our market economy is not allowed to be a market economy, which is some ways in which we're not allowed to have a level playing field. But I think if we do get to the point where we have a level playing field where the cost of creating power is truly accounted for, and once you as a consumer have to truly pay that cost instead of having it hidden away on your back taxes, in the, you know, the back end of your taxes, I think tremendous things can begin to happen. And I think unintentionally Europe has created a system like that, in that they have the extraordinarily high gas prices, which has changed most of the behavior over there. And I think in large parts of Asia, we have tremendous amounts of public transportation that are done really well because they have been able to achieve densities that we don't have here yet, but I think we'll probably begin to approach. So yeah, you know, you can see signs of where the U.S. is heading by looking at sort of like the Northeast Corridor and, you know, parts of L.A. L.A. is doing a lot of, you know, density things. Portland is doing a lot of things. And you kind of have to look to those cities and think, yeah, you know, parts of the U.S. are basically, even though, you know, the rest of it is kind of going la, 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 fingers in the ears, I can't hear you. There are major parts of the U.S. that are basically saying, you know what, screw it, we're moving ahead with this, and we're self-organizing. And, you know, life goes on.
Yeah, and I don't want to talk too much about politics, but
sure.
About politics, but it's just so interesting to me because, you know, you talk about market economies, and I completely agree with you that, you know, a health insurance company is gonna eventually. I'm looking forward to this lawsuit, by the way, where you know, a Blue Shield or some insurance company basically sues, I don't know, some oil company. But it just seems to me that it makes almost no sense to me why there are not more sort of large like oil companies who are saying, you know what, green technology is really the future because we have a finite resource. I mean, that oil,
sure.
We're not going to like just magically like find a Virgin Mary who spews oil or something, right? So it seems to me like, why are they not investing massive amounts into selling something which quite honestly is going to make them filthy freaking rich?
Because they're already filthy rich?
They're already filthy rich. Year that they delay, you know, having to pay, you know, the price of pollution is another year that they get record profits, you know.
They make,
you know, so for them it's a win-win scenario. If they can delay, you know, regulation, if they can delay, you know, carbon pricing, if any of those things are delayed, then on the back end they make more money. And I think even, you know, it's one of those cases where, like, you know, the cigarette companies just tried to delay it as long as they could, even if they thought it was coming around any moment. You know, you saw this period of time where they just, hey, if we fight this, every year that we delay it, every year that we put doubt into the minds of everyone else, every year that we can kind of, you know, get people to wonder if these things are true or not, is a year that we make lots of money and don't have to get hit by huge, you know, huge changes to our business. And so, it, you know, from a completely rational economic point of view, what they're doing is not surprising. You know, it's what companies are supposed to do. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that you, you know, have to either change and regulate, or you can do cap and trade, or you can just quite simply, you know, charge them for causing pollution. And as a sort of market-oriented guy, I'm a huge fan of market economies. I think, hey, you know, a carbon tax kind of makes tremendous sense because, you know, it is a tax. It is a direct cost. You know, I think the marketing of it is bad. I think calling it a carbon tax is really bad. I think we need to find a way to name it something that sounds, you know, because right now lots of people think the word tax is bad. So we need to call it carbon, something that indicates that they're being charged for causing us money, causing us to have to pay for their mess, you know. So call it carbon recapture investment fee, you know, something like that. That's a little clunky. I'm just thinking of it right here on the spot. But, you know, carbon tax is bad optics. But you really want to call it, you know, like the, you know, the carbon pollution recovery fee. You know, to sort of indicate
like
to people
one.
What it
I'm
is.
I'm digging it.
Yeah, the carbon pollution recovery fee.
Bam.
Boom.
So you should work for a PR firm. You know, for yeah. You should, why aren't you working for Obama? You know, you.
But you know,
so Sean just said that we're not going to talk about politics. We're going to redirect us. So.
Yeah.
because my favorite point in the entire book was when the stripper at Pussy Galore's tears Annika a new one about the structure of her business. And you play with, you know, the kind of various political and corporate structures fairly often. And then you have, you specifically mention Thule, Piri, and Pythias. Am I still pronouncing that wrong, Sean, or did I finally get it right?
You got it right.
Thank you. And, you know, the Piri and Pythias are like, you know, kind of diametric opposites. One is a benevolent dictatorship and the other one is totally democratic. Everybody has a say in things. So what is it that you find so sort of valuable in terms of the discussion and in terms of science fiction? Sorry.
Well, I'm always intrigued by different political structures and arguments about which one works more effectively. I had a lot of fun recently reading about the revolutionary era and the formation of the U.S. and what the founding fathers thought about pure democracy versus representative democracy and how, you know, we came up with the system that is here. And I was extremely fascinated recently by what Iceland did in terms of crowdsourcing its newest constitution. After the great big financial collapse that they went through, they also went through a process of redoing their entire political structure, which just kind of blew me away. It's just like, here's a whole country that just, you know, kind of up and decided like, hey, we're going to have a whole new political structure. Let's go do it. And that capacity for doing something like that is just very intriguing. And I started thinking about the question of, you know, as we build a frontier up here in the Arctic North, what's going to happen if, you know, people start to self-organize under different methodologies? So I just basically created Thule, different people pronounce it different ways. Just tried to create a way of demonstrating the, you know, opportunities that are out there for people to, you know, organized under different methods. We also talk a lot about sort of offshore libertarian sort of fantasies about what would happen if people, you know, got off, you know, out of international territories and into open water, you know, and decided to create different structures. So I just wanted to play with that a bit and show off some different potential political structures, sort of techno-democracy where everyone gets a vote in everything, or radical transparency where nothing is kept secret. These are just some concepts that have been floating around and played with on the internet quite a bit. And I was really fascinated at right after I finished the novel to see the way in which the People's Microphone and the General Assemblies worked with
Occupy
Wall Street. And that led me down to even reading about the way in which Quaker meetings are held, which I hadn't read about before, which I found immensely fascinating. So there are lots of ways, and those are the political ones, but to me what is interesting is that I've gone through this process. In 2006, I was laid off my day job, and I became a freelancer. And so I've been a freelancer now since 2006, so I'm getting into my sixth year of kind of working for myself. And one of the most fascinating things for me is how much my relationship with work and how I think of work and how I think of corporations has changed in that 6 years. I've always assumed that you had a job, you went to a day job, you worked at it. And even though I wanted to be a full-time writer one day, I never really thought of, you know, too hard about the ins and outs of it. And what has intrigued me is that by leaving the structure of a day job is I found out that most corporations are totalitarian and dictatorial environments and are truly somewhat horrendous and very hierarchical organizations. So, I mean, here's the funny thing. We live in a democracy in the Western world, and most people who are probably listening to this live in a Western democracy of some sort. And if you aren't, hi, very interesting how far right. This podcast is spreading. But I'm going to assume most of our listeners are American. So you ostensibly live in a democracy.
Right.
And you're proud of that fact, and you think it is the best way for a country to work. Otherwise, you'd be agitating for dictatorship or moving out of the U.S. So if you choose to remain in the U.S. or, you know, the Western world, so to speak, and if you choose to continue living in a democracy, then what are your choices that you're making about where you work? How are they being reflected? I'm betting you that if you take the structure of your workplace and map it as a political structure, you're going to find that what your beliefs about a workplace are and what you accept in a workplace are radically different than what you expect out of your country mm-hmm. and how you live in a country. And the first thing I noticed is that upon leaving a workplace, the harder I work, the more money I make. Now, that's fairly epic. Most of my friends basically live as communists. Right. Even though they live in a free, you know, society, when they go to work, they leave a free society behind. They accept the monitoring of their email. They accept taking orders. They accept the fact that their salary, for the most part, is not going to change no matter how much harder they work. And as a result, they work with mediocrity or worse. And if they drag their company down and don't work too well, there's a chance they might be fired. But as long as they meet a certain minimum, they can probably just get through it. And, it's strange that people who, you know, talk about the fact that, you know, having, you know, subsidized health care or universal health care is the most evil thing in the world, but then they expect it of their job. And their job decides where their health care is and what kind of health care they get, not them. So it's amazing. Their freedom to choose healthcare is taken away from them. Their freedom to choose autonomy in most of their daily life is taken away. No matter how hard they work, for the most part, the amount of money they make is not going to change. Most of them don't have any form of profit sharing. And most of them are probably even really grateful and sort of very submissive to their bosses.
Right.
And that's sort of stunning if you think about it, that there are not many corporations out there in the U.S. that are democratic, even though we say that the democratic way of self-organizing is the best in the world. It's the most effective way of doing things. But when it comes to the structure of our corporations, they're not. Now, if you start saying that corporations should be worker-owned, immediately people start saying you're a communist or a hippie or some sort of socialist. But socialism just means that the government controls the means of production. It doesn't mean that you should have worker-oriented workplaces. You know, when we say that we're a market economy, it just means that you have the freedom to own property and sell things and engage in capitalism. It doesn't say that your corporation has to be run by a boss in a hierarchy in which you have no control over anything. And it's just like, wow, we've decided to like radically just not experiment with our companies that much. Mm-hmm. And it really started to fascinate me, and it really started to actually bug me. And so part of the stuff I'm doing in Arctic Rising was trying to explore the consequences of that out a little bit and sort of maybe posit some alternatives. And I'd like to dig into it a bit more in upcoming books and talk about it a bit more. But yeah, it's one of those things where I talk to people who've left day jobs and work for themselves or own their own companies, and they're all like, oh yeah, 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 yeah. You know, that's just one of those blinding moments you have when you leave that. You go like, oh my gosh, I wouldn't stand for this if it was a country.
Yeah. I think that's part of why Jen loves the strippers pussy galore moment where she castigates Anika
let's be honest, I'm a commie Californian, so.
But it's a very interesting, you know, the idea that a corporation, and not all corporations, but many corporations are these hierarchical systems where most of the people don't benefit from the massive profits of the system itself. And
totally.
It's sort of like, well, it's completely logical to think that, well, if I worked, you know, for $8.50 an hour, which is above minimum wage, and you know, I just did whatever, I just entered data, and the company made $2 trillion, and I still only got $8.50, and maybe if I'm lucky, I got a raise. Maybe. Right.
Right, and I think that's, I mean, I don't want to dig into politics in the United States too much, but that was kind of one of the big benefits of being a part of a union, market, is that you had that power to, you know, organize around specific goals. You could get, you know, the higher wages. You could choose your own health insurance company. The company understood that having workers invested at that level in their company would make them work harder for it, and it worked out. With the, you know, kind of erosion of the union system, you see more and more businesses like pussy galore is popping up in the United States.
Thank goodness. It's just funny because the vast majority of working Americans have decided to work under a system that's very little different from Soviet Russia, which is that you agree to work for a large soul-crushing organization, which gives you enough to live off of. You know,
I'm making my husband listen to this.
And decides your health care for you, and you know, decides how much everyone in the organization is going to make based on rules from its up there. Okay. And you know, when you have unions involved in that, you have a little bit more power on the worker side. But if you look at a sort of, you know, organization in which everyone is given a share of the overall profits, then you change the equation quite drastically. A worker-owned business, you know, which uses a democratic, you know, and I love democracy. It's one of the reasons I love living in, you know, the sort of developed world. And so it's just sort of like, yeah, I'd love to see more business oriented in that, particularly since some of these, and let's bring it around full circle. Here we go. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Some of these same businesses that are basically like basic Soviet Russias, you know, that are working here are the same businesses that are working so hard to get profits for the immediate future, you know, deny that global warming is happening, fund global warming denial, and, you know, to give it time to extract as many resources as they can and pollute as much as they can, because they're not being run by the people who are its aggregate workforce. They're being run by a handful of individuals who are living for the now, who are making so much money that they just could give a crap, and who are basically autocrats, dictators. They are, you know, sort of just reaping all of these benefits. And so, you know, when you're the person on top of that massive pyramid, you don't care how crushing it is for everyone else down there, because you live like a king, quite literally. And if you're looking at the difference between what a CEO now of these soul-crushing large corporations makes and the guy on the very bottom, it's so vast that they might as well be the kings and princes. And it's just one of those reasons why I was just sort of like, you know, hey, we live in a representative democracy. Let's imagine what a representative democracy-like workforce would look like. And yeah, it's not exactly new. The worker-owned businesses are, you know, it's an old concept, but I just wanted to sort of talk about it again, because in this digital age, and you see a lot of this happening in Silicon Valley, in this digital age, we have more opportunities for people to sort of maybe reorient their workforces, reorient their working environment to be more like the actual country they live in.
Right. Your book is just so subversive, I just got to say. I think I'm going to be handing this out to all my Occupy friends.
I wouldn't say it's subversive. I think
it's a little bit.
He plays with all sorts of stuff. It's not like all of it is anti-corporations. Like, all of these kinds of things are at play. It's not quite subversive. It's just clever.
But the thing is, it's like, hey, let's give, you know, let's have more and more people make their own corporations, I think, is where I feel the benefit comes from. I think we need more people like, you know, Stephen Colbert creating their own super PACs. You know, it's sort of like, oh, okay, if you want to give this power to a corporation, then what we need is not to become anti-corporate as such. It's basically to start grabbing those tools for ourselves as fast as possible in order to blunt the sort of uneven relationship that exists right now, which is why I say I'm looking forward to, you know, healthcare operations suing, you know, large energy producers to recapture the costs that they are causing. I'm looking forward to those kinds of lawsuits. I'm looking forward to, you know, I'm looking forward to what happens when, you know, people who are saying, you know, get rid of taxes, get rid of, you know, welfare. What happens when the federal government begins to defund rural roads because they're just too expensive? You know, I think all of these things are going to be very fascinating, and it'll be a very interesting shakeup.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the next 30, 40 years are going to be very, very illuminating. I mean, I'm going to assume I'm going to live that long, but
I'm hoping it'll only be like 20 years that we'll get some bigger changes going, personally.
Well, you never know.
I don't want to wait until I'm 80.
Tipping points, you know. Yeah. Sometimes, right. You know, like China decided it was going to go from zero high speed rail to thousands and thousands of miles of high speed rail, and they did it, you know, from 2007 to now. You know, it only takes 5 years if you decide to get that, you know, idea in your head and just mobilize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is and just to make a political joke, and Jen and I do a political show on the side, but one of the things that I thought was so interesting is when, you know, people made fun of Newt Gingrich for his moon colony comment. And I mean, somewhat it's silly. We shouldn't have a colony on the moon. We should do something else in space. But it does seem like that we are losing that sort of wild imagination, you know, to mm-hmm. reach for something that sounds completely insane, but to say, yeah, it's sure. insane, but we did it.
Sure. I felt, you know, actually I felt a bit bad for Newt because that, you know, I don't think there's a problem with dreaming big and saying that we should reach for, you know, having a colony on the moon. You know, as much as everyone ridiculed him for it, I thought that was somewhat, you know, misplaced ridicule, because I think those sorts of projects are expressions of your civilizational vigor, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, heck yeah, you know, I mean, there's a reason that China's all like, yeah, we're going to start, you know, sending people into space and building a moon base and getting ready for that. But, you know, that's also one reason why I'm actually very bullish about, you know, the so-called Western world. I mean, right now what we're doing is we're going through a transition where we're moving from government-led space projects to private corporate-led space projects. And so it looks like we're kind of in a lull right now. But actually, I you know, SpaceX actually does achieve some of the things they're setting out to achieve. If Virgin Galactic, you know, achieves the things they're hoping to achieve, and some of these other 10 or so different private space groups achieve the things that they're trying to achieve, I think we are actually poised to have a much more interesting age of space ahead of us over the next 30 years than we have had over the past 30 years.
Definitely. I can't wait for tickets into space to be under $1,000. I will be on that flight for sure. I want to go to space so bad. Okay, so one of the last questions before our sort of very, very last question and before I close out was, because I'm somewhat obsessed with your existence as an academic, mm-hmm. and I add that qualifier so people don't think that I'm like stalking you. I'm very curious if whether you had conceived of this book as being sort of like an early precursor to the Xenowealth series, because there are a lot of sort of political, not political, but, you know, you get sort of racial, national, ethnic issues that sort of spring up, which appear in your other novels in very, very like complementary terms. And at one point I almost was like, Rue could very well be like a distant cousin of one of your other characters. And I wondered if you had conceived of that, or if I'm just looking for things that aren't there.
I think it comes out more just because it's the same author, and hopefully those are the complementary, you know, lines that you're seeing. Some obsessions just continue book over book over book. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I am not conceiving of this as a, you know, prequel to the other books. This is just me trying to play with all the toys that I always try to play with. And I don't see Rue as becoming the next, you know, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't, this is also primarily why I chose not to have Rue as a point of view character for this book, was I didn't want everyone wondering if he would, you know, be related or similar to that character in those
Pepper.
Space opera books. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
And I do kind of shoot myself in the foot, because Pepper does come from a near future short story, doesn't he? Ultimately. So yeah, it's more that, you know, I'm playing with all the themes that I like to play with best, and there will be definitely resonances. I think there are things that you will enjoy in the space opera adventure books, the space adventure books, as well as this book. So there are things I can't, you know, stop writing about.
Well, you remember how you said soul crushing earlier with regard to, you just totally crushed my soul.
I'm so sorry. If it makes you happy, you can continue to believe what you were saying. And you know, one of the great things about being an academic is that you can just go ahead and write up the resonances and the complementary facts and present it as a very good theory, because ultimately, you know, there's author interpretation theory, which says that the author meant to do X, and then all the other theories, critical theory that comes out of, you know, the investigation of a text. And ultimately, you can make a case that it is more what you say it is.
I find it very hard. I don't know if I could do that. I mean, when an author says explicitly, I don't know. I can't. Oh,
it's your job as a lit professional.
I think it's your job as a lit professional to have fun with that.
Exactly.
I did have fun when I was thinking it. When I wrote the question, I was like, yeah, there's so much. And I was hoping, I was just, one day I'm going to figure out how to like do a fictional DNA search through your characters. I don't know how it'll work. Find out if Pepper is genetically linked to Rue.
Yeah. There's always that moment at, you know, it's closer to the end of an author's career where some of them spend the time to try and get all of their works to link together.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, right now, as of this moment, I do not see that as my goal with these books. Arctic Rising is conceived of as, you know, separate from all of that. I'm trying to play with this, you know, a techno thriller environment, and Rue comes more from my desire to. There's a really interesting song by, oh, I'm gonna have to use iTunes here real quick and come up with the actual name, and it's Barry Adamson. Barry Adamson has this song called 007, a fantasy Bond theme. And the beginning of it, it's a Calypso joint. It's a real nice little piece of music. And it's the 007 theme song done as a Calypso piece.
Oh my goodness.
And the first 5 minutes are of him talking about a young boy in the Caribbean, basically imagining that he's James Bond. And I really hooked on to that. And so Rue is more my attempt to sort of play with some James Bond and sort of imagine James Bond as a Caribbean boy, you know, starting out as a Caribbean boy who wanted to be basically a spy and his, you know, that's, you know, spent some time working for MI6 and, you know, because there's that close collaboration that, you know, the UK has with the Commonwealth still. So he's born in the Caribbean. He spent some time in the UK. He worked for MI6, and then now he's back with the Caribbean and he's doing spy operations for them. And so he's a secret agent for the Caribbean. And I just wanted to kind of invert the Bond theme. And you can see a few other obvious places throughout the book where I have little just call outs to the James Bond motif.
There is an Aston Martin in this book, which I thought was a very nice touch.
It was a lot of fun, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so, you know, that was my, this is my techno thriller. It's a thriller. It's a spy thriller. And even though it's science fiction and set, you know, 40 years down the road, it's the kind of techno thriller genre. And I love that genre very much. It's very dear to my heart. So this is, it's in several places, it's homage as well as sort of near future science fiction.
And it's awesome.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it.
I really, really loved it. I had so much fun. And yeah, I won't go down my sort
don't
of...
Don't gush too
yeah,
much.
I won't gush too much.
We did love it, though.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh,
I love the rants. Oh my gosh, they're so good. People just rant about some, whatever it happens to be, like, you know, the stripper's rant was just hilarious in their earlier rants, and I just, and I even love the part with Bish and Lars, when they're just, like, explaining what has happened while they're showing the inside of the ship, and I'm not going to say anything.
Sure.
But, you know, I just love that, just, like, the way you sort of inserted journalism into this, and even with Thule or Thule or however people pronounce it, the way they deal with being threatened is to say, well, all right, all the cameras are on and we're recording everything and distributing it everywhere. So anything that happens here, everybody has access to the information.
Yes.
So it like puts people on their toes.
It was very fascinating to me because one of the problems with a conflict is that immediately the information becomes limited. And, you know, I just thought that a full transparency approach to a war would actually be a very sort of Aikido-esque move. Because, you know, one of the things that the aggressor nation depends on is for, you know, the walls of information to shut down and for the effects of a war to not leak out as much. Because, you know, when you start bombing the crap out of a person, you get a few CNN people in there and, you know, they breathlessly show, you know, the results of the bombing. But for the most part, there's not a lot of, you know, live reporting, which would sway opinion. A lot of the really interesting stuff comes out after the fact. But if you're about to be, you know, hammered by shelling and you just go like and every single camera in this area now will just be broadcasting live to the rest of the world, then it's just like anyone with a desktop computer can just patch in and be like, oh crap.
So be on your best behavior.
Exactly. It's just one of those really slick defensive moves that I just kind of started chuckling when I wrote it.
It's really awesome. Okay, so we've got to close out. So where can people expect to sort of find you in the near future? Do you have any like convention appearances, or alternatively, as I mentioned on Twitter, any secret Ogonis underground meetings?
Yeah, I'm actually doing for the first time a conventional book tour. So I'll be up and down the East Coast starting March, or the West Coast starting March 2nd. I'll be in Portland and then going down to San Francisco and then to San Diego. And after that, I'll be doing a guest of honor stint at Millennicon down in Cincinnati and doing a book signing in Dayton sometime there in March still. March 31st, I'll be in Boston at Pandemonium Books. And then I will be at Flights of Fantasy in Albany, New York. And we're still shaping up some East Coast stops. So if you hear this and you're curious and you're on the East Coast, check my website and see if you're able to show up and say hello. The book, of course, is available at hopefully most bookstores and Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and Indiebound.com, and there will be Mysterious Galaxy has been really good. They always have signed copies, and so will most of those independent bookstores that I'll be visiting for this book tour will definitely have copies, as will hopefully your chain bookstores. And if you don't have it, ask for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely make sure my local BNN carries it, and if not, awesome. I will throw a fit.
Awesome.
They'll probably carry it, though. My local BNN is actually pretty good about carrying stuff.
Sweet. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're really excited about this book. The feedback and attention that has happened has definitely been a whole different sort of level of vibe than my previous books. So it's kind of scary and hopeful and wild.
And Tor has a lot of sort of eco-conscious books coming out this year, which is very interesting, I think.
I have not read them all yet. I'm a little bit out of the loop because I've just had my head down. I'm doing this transition to trying to write as much as possible this year and get away from the freelancing a little bit more. So I have been woefully ignorant about what's going on out there. I mean, just woefully ignorant. I've got Saladin Ahmed's first novel, Under the Throne of the Crescent Moon.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Saladin, if you're listening to this, we expect you to send us your book so that we can interview you next.
So I really enjoyed the first sections of that. I haven't finished it. I was hoping to read it last week, but I got completely snowed under. But I've been really enjoying what I've read of it so far. And then I'm on to read Mike Cole's first novel as well, Control.
Yes, read. Lovely.
Yes. Yes.
Highly enjoyable.
We interviewed him, and he was wonderful.
Yes, he's awesome. And I've known him forever and a day, so.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm looking forward to reading his first book.
We enjoyed it quite a bit. Okay, so we got to close out. So if people can find you at TobiasBakel.com. Or
I've been known to be there.
And sometimes he's there. He's got a Twitter, which is easy enough to find. I mean, if you just Googled, you'd probably find him everywhere. He's on like every social network imaginable. Maybe not every. You probably don't have like a Friendster account or something.
I finally shut down MySpace. I shed a tear, but yeah.
Do you have a Pinterest account?
I have not gotten a Pinterest account. It's not because of the great debate about whether it's for women or for men, but just because I've hit my social media like limit.
Threshold, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere
saturation
here,
point.
I just like Foursquare appeared, and I'm like, that's really clever, but no, I'm done.
I stopped it. Twitter,
Twitter and Facebook for Jen.
Facebook, Twitter, done.
She's a little bit on Google Plus, but not really.
I don't have time for anything else. So
yeah, I don't have enough time. Twitter, Google Plus, Facebook, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I don't have time anywhere else. I'm Blogger, but that doesn't really count as a social network. Okay.
Although, thank goodness for tools that make it possible to have the same comment on every single one of your social networking tools.
I don't agree with that. I'm okay with doing that, connecting Twitter to Facebook, but I don't like the Twitter to Google Plus thing. that drives me nuts.
Well, that would be against the point of Google Plus, which is right. more than 140 characters. So
right, but just some saying. People do that, and it really drives me nuts. So if you're one of those people, stop it.
Speaking of Google Plus,
yes, if you would like to send us a message, hate mail, whatever you would like to do, you can do that in four ways. You can send us an email.
Crap, skiffyandfanty@gmail.com.
I win again.
I know.
Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
Blog.
skiffyandfanty.com.
And Facebook. Well, no, wait, what's the other one? Twitter. There we go.
Twitter.com/skiffyandfanty. And on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Yep. And go get his book, Arctis Rising, Tobias Bickel's book. It's really fantastic. Everybody should read it. Even if you're not, if you've never read his original stuff, you should read this one. Or Jen and I will hunt you down and we'll strap you to a chair and make you do it.
Will we? I mean, that sounds like it would take a lot of effort, just saying.
If Tobias is okay with that, I'm willing to do it.
I need all the help I can get.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
Cool. We'll see everybody next week with whatever the hell we've got coming out next week.
Toodles.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.